Chapter 7. Courtiers wearing the French fashions outside their heads, provided they didn't carry the French ideas within. You are too young, doubtless, Cavalier, to have heard of the philosophers who are raising such a pother north of the Alps. A set of madmen that, because their birth doesn't give them the entree of Versailles, are preaching that men should return to a state of nature, great ladies suckle their young like animals, and the peasantry own their land like nobles. Luckily you'll hear little of this infectious talk in Turin. The king stamps out the philosophers like vermin, or packs them off to splutter their heresies in Milan or Venice. But to a nobleman mindful of the privileges of his condition there is no more agreeable sojourn in Europe. The wines are delicious, the women are accomplished, and though the spur I may hug one a trifle close now and then, why, with money and discretion, a friend or two in the right quarters, and the wit to stand well with the church, there's no city in Europe where a man may have pleasanter sins to confess. The carriage, by this, was descending the last curves above the valley, and before them, in a hollow of the hills, blinked the warm shimmer of maize and vine, like some bright vintage brimming its cup. The soprano waved a convivial hand. Look, he cried, what nature has done for this happy region. Where herself has spread the table so bountifully, should her children hang back from the feast. I vow, Cavalier, if the mountains were built for hermits and ascetics, then the plain was made level for dancing, banqueting and the pleasures of the villeggiatura. If God had meant us to break our teeth on nuts and roots, why did he hang the vine with fruit and draw three crops of wheat from this indulgent soil? I protest when I look on such a scene as this, it is sufficient incentive to lowliness to remember that the meek shall inherit the earth. This mood held canto presto till his after-dinner sleep overtook him, and when he woke again the chariot was clattering across the bridge of Chivasso. The Po rolled its sunset crimson between flats that seemed dull and featureless after the broken scenery of the hills, but beyond the bridge rose the towers and roofs of the town, with its cathedral front catching the last slant of light. In the streets dusk had fallen, and a lamp flared under the arch of the inn before which the travelers halted. Odo's head was heavy, and he hardly noticed the figures thronging the cafe into which they were led. But presently there rose a shout of canto presto, and a ring of waving arms and flashing teeth encircled his companion. These appendages belonged to a troop of men and women, some masked and in motley, others in discolored travel-stained garments, who pressed about the soprano with cries of joyous recognition. He was evidently an old favorite of the band, for a duenna in tattered velvet fell on his neck with genial unreserve, a pert soubrette caught him by the arm the duenna left free, and a terrific madamer with a nose like a scimitar slapped him on the back with a tin sword. Odo's glimpse of the square at Europa told him that here was a band of strolling players such as canto presto had talked of on the ride back to Donna's. Don Gervaso's instructions and the old Marchioness's warning against the theater were present enough in the boy's mind to add a touch of awe to the curiosity with which he observed these strange objects of the church's reprobation. They struck him, it must be owned, as more pitiable than alarming, for the duenna's toes were coming through her shoes, and one or two of the children who hung on the outskirts of the group looked as lean and hungry under their spangles as the foundling girl of Pontesordo. Spite of this, they seemed a jolly crew, and ready at canto presto's expense to celebrate their encounter with the ex-soprano in unlimited libations of Asti and Valpolicello. The singer, however, hung back with protesting gestures. Gently then, gently, dear friends, dear companions. When was it we parted? In the spring of the year and we meet now in the late summer. As the seasons change so do our conditions. If the spring is a season of folly, then is the harvest time the period for reflection. When we last met, I was a strolling poet, glad to serve your gifted company within the scope of my talents now, ladies and gentlemen. Now he drew himself up with pride. How you behold in me the governor and friend of the heir presumptive of Pianura. Cries of incredulity and derision greeted this announcement, and one of the girls called out laughingly, yet you have the same old cassock to your back, and the same old passage from your mouth to your belly, added an elastic harlequin, reaching an arm across the women's shoulders. See, come, canto presto, we'll help you line it with good wine, to the health of his most superlatively serene highness, the heir presumptive of Pianura. And where is that fabulous personage, by the way? Odo at this retreated hastily behind the soprano, but a pretty girl catching sight of him, he found himself dragged into the center of the company, who hailed him with fantastic obeisances. Supper meanwhile was being laid on the greasy table down the middle of the room. The madamer, who seemed the director of the troupe, thundered out his orders for macaroni, fried eels and sausages. The inservants flanked the plates with wine flasks and lumps of black bread, and in a moment the hungry comedians, thrusting Odo into a high seat at the head of the table, were falling on the repast with a prodigious clatter of cutlery. Of the subsequent incidents of the feast, the banter of the younger women, the duenna's lachrymous confidences, the incessant interchange of theatrical jargon, and coarse pleasantry there remained to Odo, but a confused image, obscured by the smoke of guttering candles, the fumes of wine and the stifling air of the low-ceilinged tavern. Even the face of the pretty girl who had dragged him from his concealment, and who now sat at his side, plying him with sweets from her own plate, began to fade into the general blur, and his last impression was of Cantapresto's figure dilating to immense proportions at the other end of the table, as the soprano rose with shaking wine glass to favor the company with a song. The chorus, bursting forth in response, surged over Odo's drowning senses, and he was barely aware, in the tumult of noise and lights, of an arm slipped about him, a softly heaving pillow beneath his head, and the gradual subsidence into dark delicious peace. So, on the first night of his new life, the heir presumptive of Pianura fell asleep with his head in a dancing girl's breast. 1.8. The travelers were to journey by Vettura from Chivasso to Turin, and when Odo woke next morning the carriage stood ready in the courtyard. Cantapresto, mottled and shamefaced, with his bands awry and an air of tottering dignity, was gathering their possessions together, and the pretty girl who had pillowed Odo's slumbers now knelt by his bed, and laughingly drew on his stockings. She was a slim brown morsel, not much above his age, with a glance that flitted like a bird, and round shoulders slipping out of her kerchief. A wave of shyness bathed Odo to the forehead as their eyes met. He hung his head stupidly, and turned away when she fetched the comb to dress his hair. His toilet completed, she called out to the abate to go below and see that the cavalier's chocolate was ready, and as the door closed she turned and kissed Odo on the lips. Oh, how red you are, she cried laughing. Is that the first kiss you've ever had? Then you'll remember me, when you're Duke of Pianura Mirandolina of Chioggia, the first girl you ever kissed. She was pulling his collar straight while she talked, so that he could not get away from her. Why, you will remember me, won't you? She persisted. I shall be a great actress by that time, and you'll appoint me Prima Amorosa to the Ducal Theater of Pianura, and throw me a diamond bracelet from your highness's box, and make all the court ladies ready to poison me for rage. She released his collar and dropped away from him. Ah, no, I shall be a poor strolling player, and you a great prince, she sighed, and you will never, never think of me again. But I shall always remember that I was the first girl you ever kissed. She hung back in a dazzle of tears, looking so bright and tender that Odo's bashfulness melted like a spring frost. I shall never be Duke, he cried, and I shall never forget you. And with that he turned and kissed her boldly, and then bolted down the stairs like a hare. And all that day he scorched and froze with the thought that perhaps as he had been laughing at him. Cantopresto was torpid after the feast, and Odo detected in him an air of guilty constraint. The boy was glad enough to keep silence, and they rolled on without speaking through the wide glowing landscape. Already the nearness of a great city began to make itself felt. The bright champagne was scattered over with farmhouses, their red-tiled pigeon cots and their granges latticed with openwork terracotta pleasantly breaking the expanse of maize and mulberry. Villages lay along the banks of the canals intersecting the plain, and the hills beyond the Po were planted with villas and monasteries. All the afternoon they drove between umbrageous parks and under the walls of terraced vineyards. It was a region of delectable shade, with glimpses here and there of gardens flashing with fountains and villa roofs decked with statues and vases, and at length, toward sunset, a bend of the road brought them out on a fair spreading city, so flourishing in buildings, so beset with smiling hills, that Odo, springing from his seat, cried out in sheer joy of the spectacle. They had still the suburbs to traverse, and darkness was falling when they entered the gates of Turin. This brought the fresh amazement of wide lamplit streets, clean and bright as a ballroom, lined with palaces and filled with well-dressed loungers. Officers in the brilliant Sardinian uniforms, fine gentlemen in French tie wigs and narrow-sleeved coats, merchants hurrying home from business, ecclesiastics in high-swung carriages, and young bloods dashing by in their curricles. The tables before the coffee houses were thronged with idlers taking their chocolate and reading the gazettes, and here and there the arched doorway of a palace showed some gay party supping al fresco in a garden hung with lamps. The flashing of lights and the noise of the streets roused Cantopresto, who sat up with a sudden assumption of dignity. "Ah, Cavalier," said he, "you now see a great city, a famous city, a city aptly called the Paris of Italy. Nowhere else shall you find such well-lit streets, such fair pavements, shops so full of Parisian wares, promenades so crowded with fine carriages and horses. What a life a young gentleman may lead here! The court is hospitable, society amiable, the theaters are the best appointed in Italy." Here Cantopresto paused with a deprecating cough. "Only one thing is necessary," he went on, "to complete enjoyment of the fruits of this Garden of Eden, and that is," he coughed again, "discretion. His Majesty, Cavalier, is a father to his subjects. The Church is their zealous mother, and between two such parents, and the innumerable delegates of their authority, why, you may fancy, sir, that a man has to wear his eyes on all sides of his head. Discretion is a virtue the Church herself commends. It is natural, then, that she should afford her children full opportunity to practice it. And look you, Cavalier, it is like gymnastics. The younger you acquire it, the less effort it costs. Our Maker himself has taught us the value of silence by putting us speechless into the world. If we learn to talk later, we do it at our own risk. But for your own part, Cavalier, since the habit cannot too early be exercised, I would humbly counsel you to say nothing to your illustrious parents of our little diversion of last evening." The Countess Valdu lived on the upper floor of a Rococo palace near the Piazza San Carlo, and here Odo, led by Cantopresto, presently found himself shown into an apartment where several ladies and gentlemen sat at cards. His mother, detaching herself from the group, embraced him with unusual warmth, and the old count, more painted and perfumed than ever, hurried up with an obsequious greeting. Odo for the first time found himself of consequence in the world, and as he was passed from guest to guest, questioned about his journey, praised for his good color and stout looks, complimented on his high prospects, and laughingly entreated not to forget his old friends, when fortune should advance him to the duchy, he began to feel himself a reigning potentate already. His mother, as he soon learned, had sunk into a life almost as dull and restricted as that he had left honest to escape. Count Valdo's position at court was more ornamental than remunerative. The income from his estates was growing annually smaller, and he was involved in costly litigation over the sale of some entailed property. Such conditions were little to the Countess's humor, and the society to which her narrow means confined her offered few distractions to her vanity. The frequenters of the house were chiefly poor relations and hangers-on of the Count's, the parasites who in those days were glad to subsist on the crumbs of the slenderest larder. Half a dozen hungry countesses, their lean admirers, a superannuated abater too, and a flock of threadbare ecclesiastics, made up Donna Laura's circle, and even Ursus Cisbio, selected in family council under the direction of her confessor, was an austere gentleman of middle age, who collected ancient coins, and was engaged in composing an essay on the Martellian verse. This company, which devoted hours to the new French diversion of the parfilage, and spent the evenings in drinking lemonade and playing basset for small stakes, found its chief topic of conversation in the only two subjects safely discussed in Turin at that day: the doings of the aristocracy, and of the clergy. The fashion of the Queen's headdress at the last circle, the marked manner in which His Majesty had lately distinguished the brilliant young cavalry officer, Count Roberto di Turnenches, the third marriage of the Countess Elfieri of Asti, the incredibility of the rumor that the court ladies of Versailles had taken to white muslin and leghorn hats, the probable significance of the Vicar General's visit to Rome, the subject of the next sacred representation, to be given by the nuns of Santa Croce, such were the questions that engaged the noble frequenters of Casa Valdo. This was the only society that Donna Laura saw, for she was too poor to dress to her taste, and too proud to show herself in public without the appointments becoming her station. Her sole distraction consisted in visits to the various shrines: the Sudario, the Consolata, the Corpus Domini, at which the feminine aristocracy offered up its devotions, and implored absolution for sins it had often no opportunity to commit. For though fashion accorded cicisbei to the fine ladies of Turin, the church usually restricted their intercourse to the exchange of the most harmless amenities. Meanwhile, the Anticamera was as full of duns as the approach to Donna Laura's apartment at Pianura, and Odo guessed that the warmth of the maternal welcome sprang less from natural affection than from the hope of using his expectations as a sop to her creditors. The pittance which the ducal treasury allowed for his education was scarce large enough to be worth diverting to other ends, but a potential prince is a shield to the most vulnerable fortunes. In this character, Odo for the first time found himself flattered, indulged, and made the center of the company. The contrast to his life of subjection at Donna's, the precocious initiation into motives that tainted the very fount of filial piety, the taste of this mingled draught of adulation and disillusionment, might have perverted a nature more self-centered than his. From this perversion, and from many subsequent perils, he was saved by a kind of imaginative sympathy, a wondering joy in the mere spectacle of life, that tinged his most personal impressions with a streak of the philosophic temper. If this trait did not save him from sorrow, it at least lifted him above pettiness. If it could not solve the difficulties of life, it could arm him to endure them. It was the best gift of the past from which he sprang, but it was blent with another quality, a deep moral curiosity, that ennobled his sensuous enjoyment of the outward show of life, and these elements were already tending in him, as in countless youths of his generation, to the formation of a new spirit, the spirit that was to destroy one world without surviving to create another. Of all this, none could have been less conscious than the lad just preparing to enter on his studies at the Royal Academy of Turin. That institution, adjoining the royal palace, was a kind of nursery or forcing house for the budding nobility of Savoy. In one division of the sumptuous building were housed His Majesty's pages, a corps of luxurious indolent young fops, Another wing accommodated the regular students of the academy, sons of noblemen and gentlemen destined for the secular life, while a third was set aside for the arestierier students from foreign countries, and from the other Italian states. To this quarter Odo Valseca was allotted, though it was understood that on leaving the academy he was to enter the Sardinian service. It was customary for a young gentleman of Odo's rank to be attended at Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.